This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Our show today is about authoritarianism, three stories that give us a picture of how freedom is lost and how and why people are willing to sacrifice that and hand it over to authoritarian leaders. We're going to start in Turkey. Amazing events in Turkey this past week as a military coup there failed, giving Turkey's president a freer hand to pursue his autocratic tendencies. Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal is going to help us put the pieces together about what happened there. It's really a fascinating story that you're going to want to listen to. Then we're going to move over to Germany. This past Monday night, a terrorist in southern Germany turned a train into a slaughterhouse in an axe attack. A string of recent terror attacks in Europe has Europeans on edge and showing a lot of anger and dissatisfaction with their leaders. And really, the stage is being set for stronger leadership there. We'll talk to Richard Palmer about that situation. Then we're going to talk about a study from a few years ago that linked authoritarian tendencies with political affiliation. Do conservatives tend to be more authoritarian or do liberals? And I'm going to finish the program with something totally different, considerably lighter. Here on the campus of the Trumpet's offices, we have a summer camp for teens going on right now. I'm going to tell you about my own summer camp experience as a teen and how it helped my relationship with my parents. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Last Friday, the military in Turkey attempted a coup against Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, but by the next day it had failed. Erdogan managed to come out on top, and now he is cracking down hard against those who tried to oust him. Turkey is a vitally important country in a lot of ways. It affects the balance of power in the Middle East. It's one of the world's most impressive militaries, a key ally in NATO. And this situation has really raised some fascinating questions about what's going to happen in this country going forward and how this will affect really a number of different geopolitical trends and prophetic trends. To talk about this, we have Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal via Skype from our office in Jerusalem. Hello, Brent.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for looking into this and trying to make sense of what's going on here. There's really quite a lot to try to wrap your head around, but I'd like to just start by asking you to give us a bit of background just about the state of Turkey. Why would the military take the action that it did?
Yeah, that's what everyone's asking, because they failed. If they were successful, then it would be probably easier to determine why they did it, because they've had many successful coups against leaders in Turkey in the past. There's been four successful coups in the past 50 years in Turkey, and yet this one is the first one that didn't come off for the army. Now, the army historically has been seen as the guardian of the secularist state in Turkey. They do not want an Islamic-led state or an Islamist society or Islamic leader well, they're all going to be Islamic that govern Turkey, but they didn't want that to be pushed on the public. They believed it should be a secular state completely. And in the coups in the past, that has been one of the main reasons that they've stepped in, is to check that Islamic rise in the leadership of the state. Now, for many years, Erdogan has increasingly Islamified Turkish society. He has removed in the past a lot of the more vocal secularists out of the military already. And this is definitely seen as a response to that. There's a quote, I've got a quote here from John Bolton, the former ambassador to the UN from the US. And he talks about this. He says, now that this has been unsuccessful, and he kind of he kind of shows what Erdogan is trying to do. He says, this means that Erdogan's relentless pursuit of an increasingly radical Islamization of Turkey will proceed largely unfettered. So that's what he was doing in the past. And the military was had enough of it, at least a lot of members of the military, and they tried to put a stop to it.
Definitely a strong push and pull between secularist and Islamist forces within, well, Islamic forces, we'll say that,
right.
within Turkey. And it actually seemed like the fact that the military did this, there had to have been quite a lot of Turks that would have hoped for a success in this coup.
Yeah, there would have been quite a lot of people that would have hoped it would succeed. But I do feel that we have seen a change in Turkey's population over the past 15, 20 years in that a lot of them have supported Erdogan and his moves to Islamify the society. They have accepted it.
One of the things that really struck me about this was how much it was popular support. Erdogan, he appealed to the people to stand up to the military, and we saw images of people lying down in the streets in front of tanks and that type of thing, and it really does have this flavor of he had the people behind him.
Exactly, and I think that is very critical for people when they're looking at Turkey and seeing a strong autocrat like Erdogan in power and realizing, and everyone can see this, that the democratic process has been in some ways, it's kind of out the window with Erdogan. While he did win in a democratic election, it was kind of pushed in his favor. But this coup is very different to what we see around the world when coups take place. Most of the time, if we look at the example in Egypt, a few years earlier, when you had Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood come in power by popular vote, but then his desire to Islamify the society was extreme, and he tried to do it so fast that the people rebelled. The people took to the streets. Now, Erdogan has been working on this for the past 15, 20 years, and the people have slowly moved with him towards accepting an Islamist government state, not a secular state. And what you had in the aftermath of Morsi taking power is that the people took to the streets against Morsi, and then the military stepped in and backed up the people. And that's what you see normally with military coups. The military isn't, most of the time, acting on its own will to install a leader of their own. They're acting against the current leadership with the backing of the people. And yeah, this is just totally different, a totally different scenario. And even as you said, Erdogan during this takeover, he called for his supporters, civilians, to use any means possible and any means necessary to stop this coup from taking place. And the people did stop it. And if you've seen footage of it, you see a lot of people in plain clothes, ordinary citizens, beating up on the military once they finally yielded.
Well, first of all, it's a little hard to accept the information that we're getting about this all at face value, because there are a lot of accusations going around. There's talk that Erdogan allowed this. Some people have accused him of actually staging this to a certain degree. But assuming that the basic narrative that he had enough popular support in order to repel a legitimate military attempt at ousting him from power is accurate, then we really have learned something about Turkey and the present composition of Turkey that we didn't necessarily see about Turkey before. We're seeing something in terms of just how far it has progressed to support his agenda that it certainly wasn't clear in my mind. I imagine that it's a certain surprise to a lot of people. It's certainly among the military. They thought they had enough support to make this happen. But maybe you could just tell us a little bit about the specifics of what occurred that caused the coup to fail.
Yeah, well, it does look like the chain of command of the military, the top brass, wasn't involved. weren't leading this, at least. Let's put it that way. And then there were a few generals involved. There were a few, a number of officers, and mostly a lot of the young recruits that they might not even been exactly sure what they were doing and whose orders they were following, and whether this was something that, at least in the initial parts of it, whether what they were doing was wrong. That from the people that have been arrested and from the people that looks like, as part of the army that were a part of this, it wasn't an entire military, a unified military attempt. The whole Turkish army was not coming against Erdogan. People looking at this are seeing it as the possible last attempt, the last try, that the point of no return at which, if we don't try now to get rid of this guy, then it's definitely a lost cause from here on out. So those people inside the military that did want a secular state and were willing to act on it, they acted on it. But there were a lot of people, like you say, that even in the military, because Erdogan had already purged the military previous to this of a lot of people that weren't on favorable of his cause and his policies. So you didn't have a full support of the military. So why did the military do it? Again, I mean, that's the big question. That's why some people are saying that Erdogan, at least if he didn't motivate it himself, which I think is a conspiracy theory, I don't think he conjured up this himself, but that he allowed it to happen, even though he might have had some information that it was going to happen. There seems to be a lot of coincidences that he was probably aware that there was a likelihood that it was going to happen. Next month, there was a tribunal of a lot of military members that were coming up to face a tribunal to be removed from their offices because Erdogan had already smelt a rat. So it shows that the fact that he was able to escape so easily and they didn't capture him, normally you have to capture the leader. That's like number one if you're going to stage a coup. You need to make sure you get him. But an hour before the helicopter arrived at the coastal sea resort where Erdogan was, he was already whisked away on a plane. They knew it was coming.
We need to get to what some of the effects of this are going to be. And Stephen Fleury was talking about this on the Trumpet Daily Show yesterday, just to the awkwardness of the relationship with Germany. He was talking about just the Turkish population with Germany coming out 5,000 strong in Hamburg, a show of support for Erdogan. And you have to believe that German politicians would not have shed a tear to see Erdogan go. One rumor was that Erdogan actually sought refuge in Germany and Germany refused it. I don't know if that's true, but it's not implausible. But what happens now to this Turkish-German relationship? It seems like Germany has been willing to work with Erdogan, in light of the needs dictated by the refugee crisis and so on. But now here he is cracking down on his military, on these men who tried to oust him. And it makes it even more unsavory for Germany to have dealings with him. But what other choice do they have?
Yeah, I think what you're seeing is the return of authoritarian rule over in a lot of powerful countries in the world. And especially when it comes to Turkey and Europe and Germany, Germany realizes that they need a partner in Turkey going forward. And whoever rules Turkey, they're going to have to work with. They may not like him. Sure, they would have rather it would not be Erdogan and get a more moderate in there to work with in the future. But what they've got is Erdogan. And it does put them in a pickle because the Europe has championed its the human rights causes throughout the world. They come out strong when somebody is cracking down too hard on their public, if they're not allowing the democratic will of the people to be voiced. Erdogan, he doesn't care about that. He has taken over nearly all the media outlets in the country previous to this. He's, as a result of this, he's purged 2,700 judges from the judicial system, those that weren't in favor of him. Somehow they were connected to the coup. Probably not, but these were people he wanted to sideline. The coup is going to be an excuse. This is a good, yeah, very good. He just, this morning, well, this afternoon, he dismissed over 1,500 deans of colleges and universities over the state, over the country as well. So he's got, because apparently they were involved in the coup. So he's using it to further strengthen his own autocratic rule over Turkey. And Germany, while they have said that they don't like that, what choice do they have? The reason reason Germany is not flooded with 2 million refugees instead of just 1 million right now is because they struck a deal with Turkey to close the border, and Erdogan, the man in Turkey, lived up to it. And that's why they're not drowning further in the refugees, refugee problem. So
there's a whole lot of factors here. You're working on an article about this for thetrumpet.com. I would encourage readers to go look at that. But really, when you're looking at this from the standpoint of biblical prophecy, the relationship between Turkey and Germany is very interesting. And seeing this going forward, I mean, we see when we look at the prophecies related to Turkey, we see a strong anti-Israel bent in Turkey, which Erdogan's ideology would certainly fit that narrative, and seeing the population behind him in this way certainly fits that picture. The relationship between Turkey and Germany, you know, in a lot of ways, it's an awkward marriage, but somehow we would expect to see this play out where they find a way to make it work.
Yeah, for sure. Bible prophecy really does indicate that the relationship is not going to be a friendship. They are going to come together because they both have pretty big needs to work together and shared desires over the fate of Israel as well. So, yeah, looking forward, you know, people might be looking at this saying, well, Germany or Europe, they have to cut off Turkey. They can't work with a dictator like this who's just completely doing away with the democratic gains in Turkey over the past 50 years. But the truth of it is, we're coming to an age on this planet where you need to protect your own, and to protect your own, you might need to work with some unsavory figures. And that is what Germany looks like they're going to have to do.
That really is a fascinating point. And I think to just look at the overall trend toward authoritarianism and the rise of strongmen, you see Putin in Russia and Xi Jinping in China, and in a sense, we're kind of seeing a move in that direction in the U.S. with people putting this priority on the personality rather than the rule of law.
I think that's a big point. Yeah, I think that. But what's so amazing about this is in any other time, or the past 50 years at least, 100 years, the people wouldn't have stood for it. They wouldn't have allowed it. Yet, just like in Russia, where the people are backing Putin, and what we're seeing in Turkey, and as you said, this was one of the things to come out of this coup, one of the things that we now understand is that the Turkish people, at least the majority, are behind the strongman in Turkey.
I guess it's a natural response to global instability, that they would crave more authoritarian leadership. But it does kind of send a chill up your spine to think about what that means for events going forward and how that's going to play out. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about Turkey. Thankfully, this man is working an article on this subject. I think it's going to be a fascinating one. There's so many aspects, so many fascinating details and angles to this story, but you can look for that on thetrumpet.com. Brent, we appreciate your time.
No problem.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The string of Islamic terror attacks continued late Monday evening when a man armed with an axe stormed a train in southern Germany and started hacking at passengers. He injured 18 people before being shot by police. Of course, this was just 3 days after the attack in Nice, France, that killed 84, and several other attacks in Europe in recent months. I'd like to talk about the effect that these attacks are having on Europeans. I have trumpet writer Richard Palmer via Skype from our office in the UK. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So these terrorists are really doing a good job of making sure that they don't stay out of the headlines for long. Maybe you could just tell us about this latest attack.
while it's particularly gruesome, I think one person who saw the aftermath just said that this train carriage looked like a slaughterhouse. And it's definitely not as many people dead as the Paris attack, but it's a very visceral image. A guy, you're trapped in a train carriage, and there's a man swinging an axe around. There's a lot of political overtones, though, on this attack. It was carried out by a 17-year-old asylum seeker from Afghanistan. And so this brings it, ties it right in with the most controversial issue in Germany today, the immigration crisis. You've got a lot of young men, especially from all of these countries. There have a lot of people that have already been raising concerns. The Cologne attacks were a watershed moment for Germany, where a lot of those concerns were proven correct. Even in the months since the Cologne attacks, a lot more has come out about some of the cover-ups. And Mr. Stephen Fleury went into a fair bit of detail on that on yesterday's Trumpet Daily Radio program. And then the other major warning that people have said ever since those Cologne attacks and even before was there are going to be ISIS terrorists come in among these immigrants. They're going to get radicalized. And now you have a 17-year-old recent immigrant from Afghanistan with a homemade ISIS flag back in his apartment. Not only that, I think he also made a video that he had sent to the Islamic State before carrying out this attack, or at least Islamic State published a video of him just very recently. So strong links with Islamic State, and he's going on an axe rampage. And so this is a lot of people's worst immigration nightmare, or worst immigrant attack nightmare proven true. And people are now wondering, how many more are there? It's not hard to get a hold of a car, a truck, an axe.
Right. It's one thing about this that they're always using different methods. It seems like Western politicians, they're always wanting to blame the weapon. They want to ban guns or that kind of thing. But the Islamists seem almost intent and calculatedly defying that conventional wisdom and demanding that the politicians focus on them and on Islam by finding new ways of attacking.
Right. And I think it's because banning the weapon is easy compared to actually confronting the problem for what it really is.
Acknowledging reality. Yeah.
Right. It's probably easier to ban axes than it would be for Germany to actually get to the point where it could weed out radicals. I mean, it can't weed out radicals. It would end up having to have some kind of blanket policy against all Muslims. I mean, you're talking about major, major changes, major challenges. So when people, they're struggling to do something, and about the only thing they can think of doing is focusing on that, on the weapon.
So because this is a manifestation of this worst nightmare scenario regarding immigration, maybe you could just talk about some of the political effect that this attack is having. The one in Nice, in some ways, definitely associated with the Islamic State, or the Islamic State took responsibility and said that he was a soldier of the Islamic State. This was probably even stronger connections. But what are people saying about that?
Yeah, definitely major political ramifications in both Germany and France. This is Angela Merkel very strongly associated herself with this immigration push. The backlash against her in the wake of this axe attack hasn't at least hit the English press yet. It's been less than 24 hours, but I imagine it will come pretty soon. We'll start hearing politicians say laying this at Ms. Merkel's door. A lot of people are expecting that. And really, this puts Angela Merkel in a very, very tough spot. You know, her immigration policy is looking like a dreadful failure right now. Her plan B for solving all of these problems and for stopping more immigrants coming into the country, for stopping these problems from getting worse, was Turkey. And that has now completely fallen apart. A few months ago, she was Turkey's new best friend. And she was going around Europe trying to persuade the rest of Europe's leaders to allow visa-free travel with Turks. She was promising Turkey that they would make real progress on its bid to join the European Union. And people were saying, well, Turkey, you know, they could be an EU member in the next 5-10 years. now, I think it was just today, she was up there giving a speech threatening to kick Turkey out of the EU accessions process just after there's a whole load of details that we don't know about that coup over the weekend, like we've been talking about already on this program. But one thing we can see already is that it has radically changed Germany and Turkey's relationship. And Ms. Merkel's plan B is kaput. It's completely broken. It would be very hard to see how she could go back to now trying to get visa-free travel for Turks in exchange for Turkey stopping migrants coming into Europe. So this political ramifications in Germany, they all go straight to Angela Merkel. But then in France, it's been a very different reaction after the Nice attacks to the other two. I mean, we talked about a bit on Friday how in the past François Hollande's popularity has actually gone up slightly after the other attacks. There's been this show of solidarity. I'll just read a few headlines from major European newspapers. It gives you a sense of what's going on, European and American. Moment of silence turns into outcry against government after Nice attacks. Nice attack has a bisexual Muslim hustler put France on the path to civil war. Nice attacks propel anti-immigrant sentiment into France's mainstream. French government faces backlash over Nice attack. Hollande under fire over Nice attack. Attack on Nice, French PM Valls booed at commemoration.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very different response now. And you just within hours or just a day or two of the attack, you had Nicolas Sarkozy and other French opposition politicians, instead of making a show of solidarity with François Hollande, they were very heavily criticizing him, saying that he'd done nothing that he should have done to prevent these attacks. So you've got a political, you can see how this is feeding a political crisis in both countries.
It is really amazing to watch how the trend in public response to crisis, and we see this happening in the United States as well, it's like every time an attack like this happens, it rather than the country unifying in response and saying, you know, we need to basically fortify our defenses against our common enemy, it is exposing the divisions within the countries. And you see in what you're describing in France and Germany, both the divide between the populace and the politicians, the divide between those with more liberal tendencies and wanting to accommodate the immigrants and this more anti-immigrant, even pro-nationalistic, much more belligerent type of response taking place. How is that going to be resolved? It seems like really what you're describing with the political vulnerability that both Hollande and Merkel are experiencing, there's just a real leadership void, and there's a lot more people in those nations that they're crying out really for, it's like what we were talking about with Brent earlier about just wanting more authoritarian leadership.
I think it gets back to the point you made just a few minutes ago about, for example, liberal governments tending to try and blame the weapons instead of the terrorists. It's they've been going for the easy, obvious solutions. And by the time you're in your third terrorist attack in 18 months, it's clear that that's not working. And so there's a demand for change.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the people in France, they are fed up of more of the same. And who is going to make those radical changes that would be necessary to actually stop the handful, probably more than a handful, of radicals within the millions of Muslims that are in these European countries, tens of millions across Europe? It's going to take a strong man, or at least a very strong government, to be able to do that. And so they see what has happened is not working. I saw some statistics the other day just showing how, when it comes to sacrificing freedom in return for more security, an overwhelming majority of French people are willing to sacrifice more freedom. They want to give up more freedom in return for more security. They're desperate for more security, for a government that, even if it means, I mean, they've given up a lot of their, what would be considered, I guess, constitutional rights as Frenchmen. They've given a lot of that up already in the 9 months of state of emergency that we've seen, but they want to give up more than that because they want someone to keep them safe. I mean, ultimately, that's what we want more than anything else. We're willing up to give up everything in return for staying alive. And so people are getting more desperate and they want somebody with the strength to fix the problem, even if they have to pay a high price for that.
And really, when you look at history, I mean, that has been the trend. It's been the crisis that has provided the person with autocratic, tyrannical tendencies the pretense that he needs in order to step up and propose himself as the solution.
Yeah, I look at the, and somewhere there's so much symbolism on the Nice attack, you know, on Bastille Day. The word terrorism comes from that day, essentially. It was invented, the English word terrorism was invented to describe the French Revolution and its aftermath, the reign of terror, the people that died. And after that, you know, so many people had, they'd risen up to, for their ideals and for freedom. But after all of that death, after all of that terrorism in the French Revolution, they were willing to give that all up to a strong man, Napoleon Bonaparte. And the country very quickly, after all of this upheaval, all of this death, were ready to just pay any price for a strong man to come in and finally stabilize things. Now, we're nowhere even close in terms of terrorism in France to the reign of terror of the French Revolution. But it's the same kind of thing. Once you start to get terrorism, they're willing to bring in that strong man.
Yeah, really, really a fascinating trend that we see playing out in several areas. And what we saw within Turkey, what we're seeing in Russia, what we're seeing in China, what we're seeing in some degree in the United States even, it definitely points to the prophecy of a strong man rising within Europe. I mean, really, that's probably the signature prophecy that we expect to see unfold in the time ahead. And you see, as these crises intensify and multiply, that the call for that kind of leadership is going to increase even more than we see already.
Absolutely. I do want to point out, I think that is the strongest prophetic trend we see from this. I think the other one that's worth pointing out is, you know, on Monday, the French foreign minister, he was meeting with the EU foreign ministers, all the foreign ministers, and he was calling for, again, much greater progress towards a European military. They all hearkened back to those calls that France made after the November attacks, invoking Europe's self-defense clause, and he was calling for more help from other European nations, because France has been pretty much at its limit when it comes to getting involved in North Africa and the Middle East, and it's trying to get more European nations involved in North Africa, involved in the Middle East, and it's trying to set up then some kind of European military structure to coordinate that. So we're seeing it move forward as well. So it's pushing a whole range of prophetic trends forward.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about another terrorist attack this past Monday in southern Germany. And its ramifications really go on and on when you put it together with all of these other events that have been happening. We always appreciate your insights, Richard. We appreciate your time. Thanks for the interview.
Great to be here. Thank you.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
About 4 years ago, a study came out saying that people who are politically conservative tend to be more authoritarian. Three academics from Virginian Commonwealth University wrote a paper called Correlation, Not Causation, The Relationship Between Personality Traits and Political Ideologies. The abstract of that paper said that the study results suggest that personality traits do not cause people to develop political attitudes. Rather, the correlation between the two is a function of an innate, common, underlying genetic factor. I have to apologize in advance, but I'm going to read a little bit more of this. It's a little thorny language, but it says, in line with our expectations, this is from this paper, P for psychoticism, positively related to tough-mindedness and authoritarianism, is associated with social conservatism and conservative military attitudes. We also find individuals higher in neuroticism are more likely to be economically liberal. Furthermore, neuroticism is completely unrelated to social ideology, which has been the focus of many in the field. Finally, those higher in social desirability are also more likely to express socially liberal attitudes. And as they said, this is what they expected to find when they undertook this study, because liberals are so much nicer, right? Well, this year, 4 years after the initial study was released, the authors issued a major correction to the findings of this study. This is what they wrote this year. The interpretation of the coding of the political attitude items in the descriptive and preliminary analyses portion of the manuscript was exactly reversed. Thus, where we indicated that higher scores in Table 1 reflect a more conservative response, they actually reflect a more liberal response. Specifically, in the original manuscript, the descriptive analyses report that those higher in psychoticism are more conservative, but they are actually more liberal. And where the original manuscript reports those higher in neuroticism and social desirability are more liberal, they are, in fact, more conservative. In other words, it's liberals who actually tend to be more authoritarian and exhibit more psychoticism, where it means they tend to be more uncooperative and hostile and troublesome and socially withdrawn and manipulative. Now, what's interesting is the author of this study said that this was just a minor error. This is from a Washington Times article that talked about this when they issued this correction. They said the mistake, this is one of the authors that said the mistake doesn't affect the outcome of the research. The Times says this man said the study's primary purpose was to demonstrate the magnitude of the relationship between political beliefs and personality traits and its source. So the direction of the relationships wasn't all that important, except that when the study originally came out, the press was all over this. They absolutely loved they loved the idea that, you know, conservatives are authoritarian and that they're socially uncooperative and hostile and troublesome and manipulative. That's conservatives. The press really loved that story. But then when the retraction came out, you didn't hear very much about it. It was mostly a few conservative blogs that reported on it. The press really isn't interested in hearing much about the authoritarian tendencies of liberals. But this isn't just an interesting piece of trivia. There's really an important point to be made here. In modern politics, there's a lot of talk about values like compassion and social responsibility and perennial values like equality and freedom and the like. But as much as conservatives try to position themselves as defenders of those values, those tend to be more closely associated with political liberalism. Conservatives are painted as the haters. Liberals are the compassionate ones. They're the inclusive ones. But if you step back, you actually see a quite different reality. And this study from 2012, the actual results of that study bear this out. And you really do see this taking place and unfolding in many countries. You see it in America today, certainly. those who are politically liberal really do tend to favor more authoritarian government as a means of forcing society to go along with their thinking. Selwyn Duke, he's a writer at New American. He wrote about this a few weeks ago, and he drew some important points from this. And it really should not surprise us to see this tendency borne out in this study. I'm just going to read a quote from Mr. Duke. He said that modern liberalism and authoritarianism are joined at the hip won't come as a surprise to keen observers of the political realm. As philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche wrote back in 1888 in Twilight of the Idols, liberal institutions stop being liberal as soon as they have been attained. After that, nothing damages freedom more terribly or more thoroughly than liberal institutions. Just consider the French Revolution. We were just talking about this with Richard Palmer. Exhibit A, in liberal tyranny. This event was when the terms right and left originated as they relate to politics. The first modern leftists, the French revolutionaries, sought to socially re-engineer society, beginning the calendar anew with 1789, the year of the revolution's birth, and instituting 10-day weeks that omitted the Lord's Day, reflecting their anti-Christian hostility. They also wantonly killed tens of thousands during the Reign of Terror. Included among their victims were the Girondins, fellow French revolutionaries, the 1.0 version, whose sin was not being as up-to-date as the French revolutionaries 2.0. They were branded enemies of the revolution. This phrase and the themes of anti-Christian prejudice, killing yesterday's comrades and erasing the past, would be repeated by future leftist regimes. The Khmer Rouge in 1970s Cambodia had their year zero and exterminated up to one-third of the nation's population. The Soviet Union's Joseph Stalin spoke of utterly destroying the old Bolsheviks, had people airbrushed out of history books, and killed at least 20 million people. China's Mao Zedong tried to eliminate every vestige of the nation's heritage, somewhat reminiscent of the Islamic State and Taliban. He destroyed Buddhist statues, and he murdered perhaps 60 million of his countrymen. Now, these are obviously very extreme historical examples, but the fact is that it's the ones that really have these revolutionary liberal-type ideals. In order to enforce those radical ideas, they have to resort to force. We've had a group of us here among the Trumpet staff reading the Constitution Reader. It's a book that's put out by Hillsdale College that has just dozens of original documents from the founders of America and what was established in America, just spelling out the ideals that established this country. And what happened there really was a radical departure from the kind of authoritarian rule that had characterized so much of human history. Those men worked so hard to get the balance right between the government's power and the government's accountability to the people. It had to be strong enough to deal with threats and to punish lawlessness, but its primary purpose was to safeguard the rights of the individual, the freedom of the individual to go about their life as they wanted, to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, to worship God as they wanted, to have the freedom to act according to their conscience, to believe as they wished, to live and to work with really as little governmental interference as possible. These are the ideals that were enshrined in the Declaration of Independence and that were organized in the Constitution. And reading through all of this, it has helped me to realize far more forcefully that the last 100 years, especially in the United States, have seen a gradual erosion of those principles in this country as we've become more politically and socially liberal. When you start putting a higher value on your ideas of equality than on individual responsibility, then you start sacrificing freedoms. The more you remove responsibility from individuals and you put it into the hands of the government, You have to increase the size and the power of the government. And in the writings of America's founders, you see this tremendous effort these men made in grappling with this push and pull, the effort to preserve as much freedom as possible, to leave it in the hands of the people. And they talked so much about the rights that were given, natural rights given by God to people, and it's the government's job to safeguard those rights. And anytime a government exceeds that mandate, then they're exercising power illegitimately. I'd really encourage anyone to read those documents, read the Federalist Papers, read why America's system was set up the way that it was. It'll give you really tremendous perspective on just how special what was established in America really was and how far from those principles we have gotten. And it'll also give you a good idea of where the road that we're traveling now is taking us. America is where it is today because we've thrown out what the founders built, and we've built a liberal, socialistic state in its place. And more, we're seeing the effects of the low regard that we have for those founding principles, the way that we've really thrown aside the freedoms that it guaranteed for us. People are becoming more and more comfortable with trampling on freedom in order to secure what they believe are more important benefits. This is why I really see a relationship between, say, what we saw in Turkey, what we've seen in Russia, what we've seen in China, what we're seeing more and more develop within Europe, and the trend within the United States. Because when freedom goes out the door, when people don't put a high value on it, and when they're not really willing to defend it, someone is going to seize it, and they're going to use it for their own purposes. This is another quote from Selwyn Duke: "The left's tyranny isn't congruent with its principles. It really hasn't got any principles, but it's merely proportional to its power. It's as tyrannical as it has power to be. While we don't yet have death squads, we do have death of truth squads with dissent-stifling leftist disgorged speech codes on college campuses, workplaces, and elsewhere. We see leftist state bureaucracies persecuting private business owners for not servicing politically favored events like same-sex weddings. And we just recently witnessed the San Jose police allow a violent leftist mob to attack Donald Trump supporters." So there is more and more of this, basically, this show of force in order to secure what they believe are higher principles than those of freedom and individual responsibility and the rights of someone to act according to their own conscience. This road America is going down, this is actually well-trod soil, and it's not going to end well. The folks who are throwing around words like justice and equality and basically demanding that their version of those values and their rights be secured by any means necessary, this is the road to authoritarianism.
It's time for today's last word.
The summer I turned 17 was somewhat of a low point in my relationship with my parents. It wasn't terrible, but it seemed we were arguing over more and more silly things. I thought they didn't trust me. They thought I was drifting away from them. But something happened that began to turn that relationship around. That summer, I spent 3 weeks in Orr, Minnesota at a summer educational program, SEP. It was a camp sponsored by my church. It was full of activity, sports, water skiing, a canoe trip, dorm life, dances, as well as instruction in Bible studies, fireside chats, fellowship with ministers. And I realized at that camp that I had not been honoring my parents as I should have been. I resolved that when I returned home, I would do my part to make the relationship better. I didn't realize it at the time, but this change in my attitude was actually fulfilling an Old Testament prophecy. In a letter he wrote in 1984, Herbert W. Armstrong, the man who founded the church I attended, the Worldwide Church of God, he wrote this: "Here in Australia, I have visited the SEP summer camp for youths 13 to 18 years of age. Words simply cannot describe the importance of these summer camps. These hundreds of young people will be adults being married and having children in just one decade. They are learning God's way of fun, and they're being taught God's truth. Their lives are being changed. These camps and the church YOU program for youths worldwide," and I'll talk about this in just a little bit, "they're turning the hearts of the children to their parents and the parents to their children. And in this age when families are being broken up and youths are turning to alcohol, drugs, sex, and violence and becoming strangers to their parents, that is one of the vital things God is doing through his church, as prophesied in Malachi 4 and verse 6. That's the prophecy I was talking about. And later in this letter, Mr. Armstrong wrote, "Not only are these summer camps of such supreme importance, but also our program of working with you parents so you may come closer to your children." He wrote this: "I call on you to have a closer relationship with your children. The last two verses of the Old Testament are a prophecy showing how important that is for you today." So this is what those verses say. Malachi 4, verses 5 to 6. "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord, and he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse." Those words beautifully describe Mr. Armstrong's work. Over his 57-year ministry, he worked intensively to build families and turn hearts. The YOU program he mentioned was Youth Opportunities United. As a teen, I attended regular YOU sporting events, dances, talent showcases, fundraisers, and socials with my peers and my parents. In its publications, the church printed regular articles on marriage and family. They taught about dating, sex, childbirth, every aspect of every phase of parenting and child development, even grandparenting. Beginning in 1981, it began printing Youth Magazine for teens with frequent articles on building strong intergenerational relationships. Mr. Armstrong also founded three campuses of Ambassador College to teach true values to young people. Every effort was made to give graduating students the best possible foundation for happy, productive marriages and families. Ministers also offered counseling to couples considering marriage in order to help them build successful and enduring families. This was all specifically meant to fulfill Malachi's prophecy. It was a job Mr. Armstrong took very seriously. And at the heart of the issue was the deep biblical truth that we are preparing now to enter God's eternal family. That's why success in building our families today is so important. It gets us ready for our future. After Mr. Armstrong died in 1986, the Worldwide Church of God turned its back on this legacy of Bible-based family instruction. Within 4 years, though, the Philadelphia Church of God was founded. That's the church that sponsors this website and this radio broadcast. And right away, it resumed the work of turning the hearts of family members toward one another. We provide solid scriptural instruction on building strong families and many other topics in our magazines, The Trumpet, The Royal Vision, on our websites, thetrumpet.com and pcog.org. Our magazine, True Education, is for teens, and it helps young people navigate life and guides them toward closer relationships with their parents and with God. Ambassador College is now closed, but Herbert W. Armstrong College has filled the gap. Our ministers regularly provide marriage counseling and child-rearing help to our members, and we hold Philadelphia Youth Camp here in Edmond, Oklahoma, and in the Philippines and Australia. If we do our job right, we will help turn the hearts of those young people toward their fathers. just like mine was turned to my parents because of the work of Herbert W. Armstrong. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Brent Noctegal and Richard Palmer. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with this thought from Philip Henry Stanhope. Great men have almost always shown themselves as ready to obey as they afterwards proved able to command. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.